out in agriculture, coyotes are often seen as pests to be exterminated, but in the city, coyotes are often seen as friendly creatures, every bit as deserving of what the city has to offer as we people. And this leads us to ask, how many coyotes should people allow in the city?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1175th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, in nature, coyotes are too small to go head-to-head with the big predators like lions and wolves, and so must become very smart and adaptable to survive. And people who catch a living off the land have developed many ways to get rid of coyotes over the years, which has forced the critters to become even more smart and adaptable. At some time along the line, coyotes got really smart and moved into town, where people do not see them as predators, but rather as friendly wildlife. Every bit as deserving of what the city has to offer as people. And so, given their smartness and adaptability, coyotes are now thriving in the city. In fact, their survival rates are said to exceed 70% in some municipalities. Given that survival rate, it does not take long for the singing predators to eat their way through a neighborhood's supply of bunnies, mice, and rats. Once nature's bounties have been consumed, coyotes must turn their attention to what people have to offer, which is essentially garbage and pets. Now, people are not likely to get ruffled about coyote eating a discarded ham sandwich, but when it comes to coyotes eating little Fluffy or Fido, that is another story. And all those missing Fluffies and Fido posters leads us to ask, how many wild coyotes should people allow in the city? And who better to ask than Camilla Fox, who is the founder and executive director of Project Coyote. Camilla, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Good to have you aboard. You know, I first saw the name Project Coyote, and having been raised in the outbacks of Montana, as it were, Project Coyote would mean one thing, but now that I live here in metropolitan California, Project Coyote probably means another thing. Is that right?
Well, I don't know what it would mean necessarily in Montana, but I can tell you a little bit about who we are and what we do.
Well, up in Montana, it would probably mean how to get rid of coyotes. But not here.
Indeed. Yeah, and I will share that I grew up in Maine, so I know what rural living with predators is like. And what's interesting to see is that I think there is a growing appreciation for predators across the country. So whether Montana, and in fact, I'd love to talk a little bit about what we're doing in Montana in the show, but I will just share with you a little bit about Project Coyote. We're a national nonprofit organization based in Northern California, and our mission is to promote coexistence between people and wildlife through education, science, and advocacy. And even though coyote is in our name, we're not just about coyotes. We're about protecting North America's native predators, native carnivores. And this includes the most persecuted carnivores, coyotes, foxes, wolves, bears, mountain lions, and bobcats, among others. And really what we're trying to do is show people that these animals have an important ecological role. And the way that we have historically been managing them, which is really mismanaging them, is not up to science or ethics. And so really what we're about is showing people how we can better safely and peacefully coexist with these animals, and how we can protect them from persecution and cruelty.
Well, that's a pretty big mission, but I'm sure you're up to it. Now, I have to ask you a personal question. How is it that a fox became an advocate for coyotes?
Well, I will share that my father, Dr. Michael W. Fox, is a fairly well-known canid ethologist. So he studied domestic and wild behavior, canid behavior, And he's written several books about wolves and coyotes and foxes. So I grew up with that, and I grew up with a variety of domestic and wild canids in my sphere. And I knew from a very young age that I wanted to protect animals. In college at Boston University, I co-founded the Students for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And then later in life, I worked in conservation, environmental conservation, and animal protection. And I really saw a need and a niche for an organization that would help protect these animals from the persecution that they are under, and to also help communities, both urban and rural, determine ways that they can better cohabitate with these animals. Well, so in addition to me, I'll just share as well that we have Peter Coyote, who's part of our team. And some of your listeners may be familiar with Peter. He's fairly well-known narrator and actor and actually a conservationist. So we have
And with a name, how could he not be part of your organization?
Exactly.
There you go. Well, first of all, I'd like to go out into the country, if we might, and talk a little bit about coyotes in the wild. I've had, of course, many experiences with them, but one of the most remarkable was being up on the Missouri River in the Missouri Breaks country, which is pretty much the last of the wild in the United continental United States. And, camping out in the river, the river was surrounded by these magnificent sandstone bluffs. And in the evenings, the coyotes would come down to the rim of those canyons, and they would start howling and singing to each other. And, of course, one coyote would sound like 10 because of the echo. So it was a magnificent orchestra that literally, sent shivers up and down my spines listening to them as all of those stars in the sky, and it was the wild. And out there, coyotes are still pretty wild, are they not?
They are. And in fact, in going back to Montana, some of the longest studies of coyotes, unexploited coyote populations, have been unfolding there for the last almost going on 3 decades now. And so it's very interesting to see a lot of the different kinds of behaviors and ecology between exploited and non-exploited populations. And as you mentioned, they do form family groups, and a lot of people's first experience is hearing that cacophony of coyote vocalizations. And for some people, it's an absolute thrill. For others, I think particularly in urban areas, coyotes are the first predator that they experience, and sometimes that first howl and that first vocalization is the first thing they experience. And so we do get calls from people saying, I heard what sounded like, 50, 60 coyotes last night. And in fact, often it's a small group, and there's something called the Bogeist effect, where two or three coyotes can sound like a whole huge pack, when in fact it's just a few individuals. But those vocalizations are very iconic, and in fact, their Latin name, the coyote's Latin name, is Canis latrans, which translates to barking dog.
Mm-hmm. And so the barking often sounds like singing or howling or hooting at the moon or whatnot, but it's a beautiful sound, but frightening at the same time. And that is the nature of the coyotes out there in the wilderness. Well, how do you go about, talking farmers and ranchers into not getting rid of the coyotes, if that's part of your mission?
Yes, we have a Ranching with Wildlife program, which is one of our 6 core programs. And that program is about working with ranchers and agricultural communities to show them that there are ways to mitigate negative encounters. As I mentioned, historically, our approach to the presence of coyotes and other predators has been generally one of extermination. And in fact, extermination was the original word used by the federal government as part of what originated as the U.S. Bureau of Biological Survey, which is now called USDA Wildlife Services. That original federal agency was established to eradicate coyotes and other predators, wolves, mountain lions, bears, and they succeeded in many areas across the country with the larger native carnivores. So historically, mountain lions, bears, and wolves existed on the eastern seaboard. Most of those have been since eradicated. through the use of poisons, aerial gunning, trapping, a variety of different lethal methods. And with coyotes, those were first encountered by Lewis and Clark when they passed the Mississippi River. Coyotes were confined to that general western grasslands. And they, at that time, they called them the prairie wolf. And again, the federal government set their sights on coyotes along with the other larger carnivores and attempted to eradicate them. But obviously
they're efforts, too smart, aren't they? I mean, they got rid of a lot of them, but those coyotes got very, very smart and very, very leery of people. And now they figured out how to move into the cities and are prospering, and that's where we'd like to take you when we get back from this short break. Folks, we're talking coyotes with you and Project Coyote. Do stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. Michael Olson here. We are talking coyotes with Camilla Fox. Yes, Fox, founder and director of Project Coyote. But I suppose you do kind of watch over other predators too, and fox being one of them. Is that true, Camilla?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So, you know, we were talking about the coyotes out in the countryside and how the federal government actually set its mind to exterminating them. And so it did exterminate a lot of coyotes. Of course, familiar with the stories of what the coyotes went through. But really, they had to become pretty smart to survive that kind of predation from people. How on earth did they decide to make the move into the city, given that natural instinct that city people are out to get them, or people are out to get them?
Well, I think it's important to understand how coyotes have expanded their range. And when you look at the ecology of coyotes, when humans hunted their greatest competitor, gray wolves, to extermination in many states, it opened up a niche for another predator to move into. So that combination of extermination of one of coyotes' greatest competitors, the wolf, along with changes in the habitat, so the removal of forests across the U.S., those two factors really led to coyotes being able to expand their range. And they have done so successfully. And really, they are one of the most intelligent, adaptable, and flexible carnivores on the North American continent. So they have been able to take advantage of a variety of different habitats. And it's very similar to jackals in other countries. Jackals exist in Africa, in Asia, in parts of Europe. And jackals, like coyotes, are a small and adaptable canine. And what's interesting is when you look at the ecology of canids and you look at the wild stray dogs in developing countries, they're a similar size as coyotes and jackals. And that's because ultimately, when you let these animals naturally evolve, that is one of the most adaptable and flexible sizes for a small predator that can take advantage of a variety of different habitats and even, you know, humanized landscapes. So
if you're if you're a grizzly bear, you're not going to be able to get under and through and around a lot of things that a coyote can.
There's that factor for sure, the size. The other factor is that coyotes can, and we know this through decades of research now, that coyotes in the face of persecution, when they are exploited, whether through trapping, poisoning, they can respond through what's called compensatory reproduction. So what that means is that when their family groups are exploited, usually it's the alpha male and female who both produce pups and provision the family group. The other females in that group are often what's called behaviorally suppressed. in their reproduction. So when you remove one of those alphas or both of those alphas, those other females in the group can start to reproduce. And then in addition, you've now created a vacant territorial niche. And so other coyotes from the surrounding areas can move in. So what that means is that ultimately, the coyote population, in the face of persecution, can rebound very quickly. And we know that through scientific research. So big picture is all the eradication efforts that our federal government is still doing, suppression through a variety of exploitation, is not working, in the sense of not working, reducing coyote populations. What we do know, and I think this is really important, Mike, for your listeners to understand, is that what we know through research is the best thing that we can do is leave coyote populations alone, whether in urban areas or in rural areas, because they will stabilize. Their populations will stabilize with those
with the environment and what's available in the environment, right?
Exactly, exactly. So when we work with ranchers, coming back to our Ranching with Wildlife program, many of the ranchers start to understand that if they're not removing the alphas and exploiting the stable family group, they can benefit from the presence of coyotes and bobcats and foxes for their natural and free rodent control. And they're essentially teaching those resident predators through implementation of non-lethal methods such as guard dogs, guard llamas, fencing, night corrals, that my lamb is not your next meal. And so they are basically teaching the resident coyote population not to predate on their livestock, but they're then benefiting from the rodent control that those predators offer. So we see an increasing number of ranchers who are understanding that and seeing that that's a better way to farm and ranch with the presence of wildlife.
Well, speaking of lambs, when they first introduced wolves into the Yellowstone ecosystem, I did a radio show with a sheep farmer up near Big Timber, Montana, right in the lee of the Yellowstone ecosystem. And this, we were talking about, of course, the wolves predating on sheep and lambs, and why this was going on, and why this and what, and the poor sheep farmer was going, I don't understand this at all. And right in the middle of our kitchen table remote, the fish and game biologist who's responsible for reintroducing wolves stepped into the back porch, and he had a tracking antenna in his hand. And he just looked at us and said, "She's back." Which, of course, meant the alpha female wolf was back eating sheep. But I said, please sit down, and as we have a live radio show, would you be so kind as to tell us why you're reintroducing wolves in the Yellowstone ecosystem? Are you trying to control the population of servants or what? And he said, oh, no. We're reintroducing wolves because city people want them there. Now, do you see city people looking at a predator like coyotes a lot differently than those farmers and ranchers do?
Well, let me first respond to that comment before, because I think that's your listeners need to know that that's not the reason why wolves were reintroduced. I mean, the wolf reintroduction program was a huge decades-long developed program by our federal and state wildlife agencies. And really the reason why they were reintroduced is because we know through decades of research that predators are vital to healthy ecosystems. So what we knew for Yellowstone and surrounding areas is that when we removed wolves and grizzly bears and mountain lions, the ecosystem was simplified, meaning that things were out of balance. And what we know is when we reintroduced wolves into Yellowstone, things unfolded through what's called trophic cascades. And so, for example, the elk population was over-browsing Yellowstone and surrounding areas. When we reintroduced wolves, those elk who were terrified of the wolves because they're a primary prey item, they moved out from many of the areas. The willows and the aspen and the riparian areas all started to to thrive in the face of having a large apex predator back on the landscape. So we know that, and that, and I just wanted to correct that, because the reason why they were reintroduced was to rebalance the ecosystem.
You know, I understand that, and what you say is absolutely true. Having seen the difference with my own eyes, you're absolutely correct. That said, still, city people want them back. And city people line up in the Lamar River Valley to just for the opportunity to see a wild wolf. And I think the same is true with coyotes in the city. City people see the predator different than those who live out in the country. And I don't know about the balance of what balance they might bring to the city, but those coyotes do bring themselves to the city and are doing well in the city. So when we get back from this break, I'd like to talk about where that's going to take us with Camilla Fox, founder and executive director, Project Coyote, and you.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what's eating what today, of course, is coyotes have moved into the cities of our country and are doing pretty good, it seems to me, just from what I see in my neighborhood and the neighborhoods I visit throughout California and whatnot. It seems like they're doing pretty darn good because they're pretty much in every city that I know of. Is that true, Camilla, or am I just seeing things?
No, I wouldn't say that you're just seeing things, Mike. I would say that we do have coyotes in most urban areas. They have learned how to coexist in many areas. I will say that throughout the U.S., as we develop areas, we are definitely coming face-to-face with more predator species, coyotes, mountain lions, bears, even wolves now in the surrounding areas of Yellowstone and in the Great Lakes areas. So, yeah, coyotes and other predators force us to ask, what does it mean to live with wildlife? How can we mitigate negative encounters? So one of the things that Project Coyote works on through our Coyote Friendly Community Program is we work with urban areas to reduce conflicts, to educate the population about how to mitigate negative encounters. And a lot of that is around human activity and human behavior. So, for example, when we do see negative encounters between coyotes and people in urban areas, very often there are two factors that are involved. One, either intentional or unintentional feeding going on, or secondly, the presence of domestic dogs. So I'll just give an example. We're based, as I mentioned, in the Bay Area, just outside of San Francisco. And we work with the city of San Francisco with their coyote education and outreach. And one of the things that we find is that there can often be a spike in the reporting and the negative encounters between dogs and coyotes during the coyote pupping season. So this is generally around April to August. Coyotes right now are in January. Coyotes are starting to pair up. They will breed in February. They're monoestrus, meaning that they breed one time a year, and generally that's February. And then they have a 63-day gestation period. So those young pups are popping out generally in about April. And it's between April and August when we see a higher incidence of negative encounters. And that's because the parents of that coyote family group are going to be more protective of their young and their den site. And those den sites might be in urban parks. So part of the education factor is just teaching people about coyote ecology so that they know when they're out recreating with their dogs during that pupping season, that it's a good time to have your dog under minimally voice control and ideally on leashes if you're in a known den site area.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just
So roughly speaking, we're talking about half the year, February to August, where people have to really be careful because I guess it's not so much
no,
that the
no, no.
it's not so much yeah, that the coyotes are hungry, but they're protective, being protective, right?
Yeah, let me just correct the time frame. So it's starting in April. So April is when the pups come out. So it's really April to July or August is the time frame for when the adults are protecting their young around a den site. After that, come fall, that's when the young from that group will often disperse, and those juveniles will leave the natal den site area and go look for their own territories and their own mates. But like I said, that time frame is one where just being a little bit more cognizant when we're out recreating with our dogs. And I'll share that for the first time in my life, I have a little dog. He's a 12-pound rescue.
Ooh, that's one meal.
Well, I also want to get back to that too, because I think we got to talk about what's accurate in terms of the coyote diet. But
okay.
Yes, my dog, I do not want to have any kind of negative encounter with, whether it's a coyote or, and let me share out here that raccoons are more dogs that come in, small dogs that come into conflict with large raccoons than coyotes in general. But so I being a good guardian of my beloved dog, I walk my dog on a leash when I know it's pupping season. So those are the kinds of things that I think are really vital. And through our Coyote Friendly Community Program, we do this public education and outreach. We provide materials to cities and counties for free. They're all on our website, projectcoyote.org. Individuals and communities can download all of that for free. And just, basic public education about coyote ecology, and not just coyotes, but other predators as well that we encounter out in urban areas, which is not unusual for places like California and places on the west and the east, where you might encounter a black bear or a
sure.
coyote or even a mountain lion.
Sure. Now, one of the things that we city people do often do, that we probably should not do, is feed the wildlife. We're notorious for feeding bears, and we always get into trouble when we do. Do you find instances when city people are feeding coyotes?
Yes. I mean, I think sometimes it's the best of intention people who are feeding wildlife, but it's not generally a good thing to do. Let's say, for example, you're feeding the deer. The deer can be an attractant for mountain lions, depending on where you live, and that can cause conflict. So in general, we suggest that people don't feed wildlife. We also work with cities and counties to enact ordinances that provide penalties for repeat offenders, because there are people who just won't listen, and then it becomes a problem for the whole community. So we do generally start in our education about how to minimize attractants, and sometimes those attractants are not that obvious. So, for example, coyotes during certain times of the year, they consume a fair amount of fruit. So if you have fruit trees on your property, considering pulling up, removing those apples and plums and apricots and other kinds of fruit that might attract not just coyotes, but raccoons and other potentially undesired wildlife, are good things and habits to get into.
So that's a significant one then. What you're providing, you're attracting the coyotes, right?
Exactly, depending. And so compost piles and even, overflowing bird seed, bird feeders. The bird seed that falls on the ground can attract rodents, and those rodents can attract a variety of different wild animals that for some may be undesirable. So again, all this information is available on our website, and they're simple things, but sometimes things that people don't think of. For example, a dirty grill. A dirty grill has odors
barbecued ribs.
You got it. And so for a canine,
there you go.
Their nose can pick up on all those odors.
And they always pick up on the barbecue. Hey, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back with Camilla, we're going to talk about what coyotes eat in the city besides little puppies and kitty cats. Must be something else they're eating on. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Camilla Fox, founder and executive director of Project Coyote, and you. Do you have a little puppy and you walking it out there? You better be careful. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back, and we are talking about coyotes. And folks, I don't know about you, but I've had quite a bit of experience with coyotes in my life, both out there in the sticks and in the city. And most recently, I've become aware of the fact that coyotes seem to be going after the neighborhood dogs. I come to that conclusion because I was visiting with my father-in-law, who has this big, huge, beautiful bulldog. He must stand about 3.5 feet tall. And they live out in the suburban areas of San Diego County. And there's a significant amount of green belt around their house. And the coyotes are out there, and they're gunning for this dog. And he's come back just chewed to shreds. And I'm just wondering, is that going to be an issue with your effort to get people to just get along with coyotes, Camilla?
Well, I'm very sorry to hear about that incident, and certainly anyone who loses an animal to any kind of wild animal, it's a tragic loss. And so part of, you know, what I've been talking about and part of our mission is to help people identify ways that they can mitigate negative encounters.
Well, here you have a situation where it's a fenced-in yard with a fence that's like 5 feet tall. And the coyotes get in there, no, regardless. They jump the fence.
Yeah, so what I do want to share is that in the urban ecology diet studies that have been done in various places across the country, what we know is that when coyotes have a bevy of anthropogenic or human foods available to them, they are most of the time choosing natural prey, so things like rodents and rabbits. They also, as I mentioned, they consume fruit and vegetation. They'll also consume snakes and lizards, among other things. So we do know that in general, they are going for the natural prey, even in the most dense urban areas. And in fact, there have been recent articles coming out of Chicago, which has had the longest urban ecology study. I think it's in its 22nd year now, where they've done a variety of different diet analyses, and they found that even in the densest part of Chicago, the coyotes are eating natural prey. And even the city council members and the supervisors there recognize them for their benefits for rodent control, because rats have been a major issue in parts of Chicago.
It's a great deal. That's, you know, that's something, you know, we're very appreciative of the coyotes for, because they keep the floor clean, right?
Absolutely. But I also want to say and acknowledge that there can be negative encounters. So that gets back to the education and what we can do to mitigate any kind of conflict, particularly with our pets. And so, as I mentioned before, you know, recognizing when and where coyotes are going to be most active, and also recognizing that, you know, particularly during that springtime when they're feeding their pups, they're going to be more protective of their den site areas, and they are going to be out foraging more to feed those pups. And I will also say that from the studies that we've seen, most of the time coyotes want to have nothing to do with us. They're generally wild and wary, and wary of humans. They also, because they're so genetically similar to our dogs, they can be very curious. So when we're out on the trail and we see a coyote looking at us, often or sometimes people will interpret that behavior as aggressive or bold, when in fact they're just showing curiosity. That said, it's also a time to, you know, if you're walking with your dog, a little dog, pick your dog up. We also recommend hazing. And so this is also called aversive conditioning. What this is basically being big, bad, and loud. So if you see a coyote on a trail and you're feeling like that distance doesn't feel safe, then shout, put your hands up, run towards the coyote, and basically do it until that coyote exits the scene. Now, like I said, most of the time when we see coyote out there, they want to have nothing to do with us. They'll be moving along. They might traverse our same path, but they're on the move. But if you're not feeling safe, then do that hazing, do that aversive conditioning.
What would you recommend for poor father-in-law who's got his dog, you know, in the yard and the coyotes are right outside the yard teasing him, roof, 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 come play with us. Is there anything he could do to, you know, chase them away?
Well, I would look at, depending on, you know, so much of this is contextual, and so we, our team sure. across the country will also do site visits to analyze, you know, whether it's at a particular ranch, farm, or individual's home, because, for example, where I live, there is a lot of open space, and some of the houses abut are adjacent to open space areas. So looking at, you know, what might be attracting in your area, if you are abutting open space or green space, looking at what might be appropriate fencing. There's something called the coyote roller, and I'm not advertising coyote roller because there are also simulations that you can do of a coyote roller, but basically it's a roll that goes on the top of a fence, and the animal cannot get purchased.
Gotcha. Coyote roller is something to look at then, which means that it would prohibit the coyote from jumping over the fence, which is always the big problem because that's just what they do. They're clever enough to see the fence as a means to get into your yard instead of a means to stay out. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to ask Camilla Fox, founder and executive director of Project Coyote, what we can do to better get along with coyotes and learn how to live with them instead of against them. This is The Food Chain, right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we do have a few minutes left, so let's ask Camilla what we can do, we city people can do, to better get along with coyotes and other wildlife. They're here and we're here, so how do we learn to just get along? And as Camilla was saying, they really do have a way of managing the environment and probably, you know, when left alone, probably do a better job than we do when it gets right down to it. Camilla?
Yeah. Well, I think the best thing, as I mentioned earlier, is to educate yourself. Most of us, you know, and I've bridged between being a rural person and an urban person. So most of us could learn more about coyotes and other predators. I'm a big believer that education is critical. We fear what we don't know, and we start to appreciate what we come to learn and understand, particularly when it comes to wildlife and particularly predators. And then we start to understand their role in the ecosystem. So I think the first thing is to educate yourself. And as I mentioned on our website, projectcoyote.org, we have a plethora of resources, information about not just coyotes, but the other native carnivores who we protect, from bears and mountain lions and wolves to bobcats and foxes. And then, as I mentioned, to look at the tips and tools and ways that we can mitigate negative encounters, whether in urban areas or rural areas, from, you know, the different attractants that we might have, from the ways that we recreate in open space areas with our domestic animals, to protecting our other domestic animals. There's an increasing number of family hobby farms, people with chickens and other small domestic animals in suburban and urban areas. So it's also important to look at predator-proofing those enclosures. And again, all that information is available on our website, and we hope people will start there and then share that information, because this is a community effort. As I mentioned, if one person's feeding wildlife, that's a problem for the whole community. So getting behind this together and working together and recognizing that coyotes are here to stay, just as other urban wild animals are. So We all can cohabitate, and we all can recognize that each of these animals has a role to play. And among, you know, coyote benefits, the free rodent control I mentioned are just one of many.
Mm-hmm. And what about us? How are we going to come to grips with the fact that we're not the only critters around, and other critters need to live? There's a substantial leap of consciousness we have to make to just get along with these animals, right?
I think it's huge, Mike. And I think one of the things that we also address is something we call nature deficit disorder.
I love it. And nature deficit disorder. Not to our city people, surely.
Well, I think it's a really actually dangerous reality that more and more people are disconnected from the natural world. And the reason why that's dangerous is because when young people aren't connected to nature and the natural world, you know, we don't appreciate and care for what we don't know, understand, and love. And so I think it's very important for us to reconnect with the natural world. And we have our Keeping It Wild program.
So thank you, Camilla. And for people who want to get in touch, Project Coyote is easy as that. Camilla Fox, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for watching out for our wildlife and to teaching us how we can do it as well. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.